From Utah Public Radio, this is Undisciplined. I'm Matthew LaPlante. It has been just about 15 years since an EF5 tornado, that is the strongest classification we have for these sorts of storms, struck Joplin, Missouri, causing widespread devastation. That tornado spent 38 minutes on the ground, tearing through churches and schools and retirement homes and grocery stores and thousands of homes. 161 people lost their lives that day, and within hours, federal officials were trying to figure out how to make sure that sort of devastation won't happen again. Of course, we can't prevent tornadoes, not with any sort of weather modification technology that is currently at our disposal, and speculative fiction notwithstanding, likely not with any sort of technology that we'll be developing anytime soon. But we can still prevent a lot of death and destruction. First, by better predicting when and where tornadoes will strike and providing better warning systems so that people can take cover. And second, by improving building codes to reflect what we know about how tornadoes push and pull and wrench on buildings. Because when we keep a building standing, we protect the people inside. And that's why the federal investigators I mentioned earlier, the ones who got to work within hours of the Joplin tornado, were officials from the National Institute of Standards and Technology, which has been working for more than a century to uncover the standards that at scale help us have confidence in the built world around us, from the ways in which fire hydrants connect to fire hoses to the amount of radiation permitted in X-ray devices, to the ways in which, in the parts of our country that are most threatened by tornadoes, roofs should be attached to homes and other buildings. That last standard has been in development since Joplin, and now it's making its way through building codes across the country. And that's going to save lives. And it all started when a team from the National Institute of Standards and Technology arrived in Joplin in the wake of the tornado. On that team was Mark Levitan. He's now the lead research engineer for the National Windstorm Impact Reduction Program and was the lead investigator for the study of the Joplin tornado, among other devastating twisters. Mark Levitan, welcome.
Hello, welcome.
Mark, you touched down in Joplin just a few days after the tornado. You'd been involved in tornado research for years at that point, but I gather that what you saw on that day was still very jarring.
Yes, been out and done field work for multiple tornadoes in the past, including there was a huge tornado outbreak a month before, but this is an individual tornado, and just the scale of destruction, as far as you could see in some places, was just much greater than any had seen before from other tornadoes.
What did you see that made it clear to you that this wasn't just a weather story, it was a building story?
In many times in other tornadoes, a lot of times houses will get hit and destroyed, and you see a lot of those, or some of the smaller buildings. But here we had a hospital building, large retail outlets like Home Depot and Walmart and others. There was just so many buildings that, you know, that were typically built stronger than houses. And many of those were just demolished or so heavily damaged. And just across miles of Joplin, not just more localized like many of the smaller tornadoes.
Did it have to do with the trajectory that it took right through the middle of the city?
The Joplin tornado at its most intense for about 6 miles through the city. It was about a mile wide, which is near the upper end of how wide tornadoes get. And sometimes some of those other tornadoes, the chances that they actually hit and the most intense part of the tornado hits the area that has a built-up population is pretty small.
You've spoken before about the risk of roofs falling up. And I was wondering if you can explain how the winds of a tornado could cause a roof to fall up.
Well, even in a straight line wind, let me start with describing that. The wind is flowing along the ground, and then it has to accelerate to go over the top of the building. As the wind accelerates, the pressure drops, and so you end up with a net uplift on the roof. That's similar to how an airplane generates lift. If you look at the curvature of the airplane wing, it's curved on the top, but it's straight on the bottom. When the plane is moving forward, the air has to take a longer path to go over the top of the wing. So if it has to take a longer path in the same amount of time as the air going on the bottom, it has to accelerate more, so you have more of a pressure drop on the top. You still have the higher pressure beneath the wing, and that generates lift. So the roof of your house is similar to the airplane wing. That's why typically we have this strong uplift on the roof, and you have to make sure that you have a positive connection, right? You have to be able to holding the roof down. Now, in tornadoes, we have all of those same geometry because we have the horizontal winds, but there's some additional factors at play because the tornadic winds and tornadic storms are very different from the other kind of wind storms that we typically design for a longer time. One of those things is we have vertical updrafts, and those vertical updrafts can go right down to the ground surface. And so now, in addition to the horizontal winds, which already generate lift and the uplift on the roof, now we have vertical winds pulling up directly and adding to the increased pressure. The other thing we have in a tornado is we have an atmospheric pressure drop in the center of the tornado. As that tornado moves over a building, if the building is staying pretty well intact, what happens effectively is you have some higher pressure, atmospheric pressure inside the building, and you have lower atmospheric pressure in the area of the tornado that's now surrounding the building. So then you have higher pressure inside, lower pressure outside. So that also accentuates the upward push on the roof. So you have kind of three different effects kind of pulling up on the roof. And pretty quickly, you can overcome the weight of the roof. And oftentimes, if a roof is not well attached and doesn't have anchor bolts holding it down, then once you exceed gravity, then the only thing that's holding it down is those connectors. And so that's one of the things that we have to do when we're thinking about designing buildings is make sure we think about that uplift force on the roof and we're planning to hold the roof down.
Because when the roof falls up and it's carried away, then that also destabilizes the rest of the structure, right? Like, and now the walls fall in, and that's what you saw again and again in Joplin, right?
Yes, exactly that. That can happen on residential buildings. That can also happen on things, especially one-story structures. Imagine things like big box stores. Once the roof goes up, there's nothing to hold those tall walls, and then those tall walls collapse.
Now, let's go back to this idea of these straight line winds, right? Because that's what we do design for. And that makes sense, right? Because those are the winds that buildings are standing against. But why does the engineering have to be so different when you're thinking about a tornado?
There's a few other differences for the tornadic winds than the straight line winds. And we have to account for all of those. For straight line winds, the wind speeds are slowest near the ground, and they increase as you move higher elevations above the ground. The wind speeds are higher aloft than they are near the ground because the friction near the ground slows the wind down. In the tornado, it's the opposite. Because the tornado, we have this vortex and we have this vertical flows that I just talked about, this uplift. So the air has to get sucked in, but the air gets sucked in along the ground. And so the fastest wind speeds occur very close to the ground surface. And so if you're designing, say, a tall building, for a straight line wind, you're designing that for the wind pressure, which is not very much at the ground and then increases with height. For the tornado, you have the opposite effect. You design it for the higher pressures at the ground, and then that's slowly decreasing with height. So that's one effect that's different. Two, we have these large vertical updrafts. We have this change in atmospheric pressure. No building is airtight. There's plenty of time to account for the atmospheric pressure change when a hurricane moves over, but there's only seconds for that for a tornado. And so sometimes, again, if a building is fairly tightly sealed, it gives us the extra uplift and the extra outward acting forces on the walls that we're used to designing for thunderstorms and hurricanes and other more common events.
And so do these differences necessitate tremendously different ways of designing buildings, or are there some relatively simple ways and relatively inexpensive ways perhaps that we can go about making sure that new construction and old construction is better suited for withstanding these very different sorts of pressures that happen in a tornado?
I'm going to give you two different answers, and those depend on what are your performance objectives. If we're designing a tornado shelter, then we're designing for Mother Nature's worst. We're looking at what's the highest end tornado that we could apply that could hit the building. What are the worst cases of all the different hazards? So we're designing for the worst case. We can still use traditional materials and methods, but it kind of takes a lot more of them and a lot more thought. If you're designing something to either what's called the ICC 500 storm shelter standard, that's a national standard for designing storm shelters, or if you're using FEMA guidance for what FEMA calls safe rooms, those are designed to provide near absolute life safety protection against the worst hurricane or the worst tornado that we can expect to experience. Now let's talk about the regular building code requirements for design of buildings. We're going to be designing kind of for the garden variety, the expected tornado that would occur with the same frequency from a standpoint of over the life of the building that we use for the regular wind speed design. So to design for tornadoes that have horizontal wind speeds of, say, between about 60 to 135 or 140 miles per hour, and that's what's in the regular building code requirements, that's actually for some fairly modest changes, which will get you to be able to resist those tornadoes, because even at 135 miles per hour, in much of the country, the design wind speeds are 110 to 120 miles per hour. Maybe you need a thicker roof deck. Maybe you need bigger anchor bolts to hold their overall roof structure down into the walls. Maybe you need more anchorage at the base of the building. But a lot of the things that we have to do to improve the basic design of the building for the most common tornadoes, that's about 97% of all tornadoes. It doesn't take a huge amount to be able to design for that. You just have to be aware of it and to improve your design, increase your design to meet the increased loads that you would see in some parts of the country.
And that's why like building codes don't need to be the same everywhere. The most likely risks where I live in Utah are earthquakes and wildfires. The most likely risks where you are in the greater Washington, D.C. and Baltimore area are severe storms and flooding. So after Joplin, NIST didn't just document damage, you also helped map tornado risk in a whole new way. What changed when we started factoring in building size and exposure, not just likely storm intensity?
In our analysis and the subsequent work that we did, we found that the size of the building plays a huge effect on the wind speed risk. After our detailed study of the tornado and its impacts, we made a set of recommendations and we submit those. And we were then on the hook, and we have to report to Congress every year. Some of the core recommendations that we made included we have to have a better understanding and a better hazard mapping of the tornado risks. We have to develop a methodology to be able to determine what are the tornado loads and how different they are from these other kind of wind loads. And then we have to work to get that methodology into building standards and building codes. So in our analysis, we found that the plan area size of the building is critical to determine the tornadic wind speed risk. So if you have a small building like a house and you have a big tornado like in Joplin that's a mile wide across, then that whole building is engulfed in the flow field of the tornado. But let's look at the opposite end of the spectrum. Maybe you've got a 20 or 30 yard wide tornado, but you've got a 1,000 foot long warehouse building. Well, that warehouse building is far bigger than the width of the tornado. And so when that tornado strikes that building, the tornado just kind of cuts a path right through the warehouse, and the one edge of the left edge and the right edge of the building are still there, but it's just missing the middle of the building.
Right.
Because the tornado is so much smaller. And so when you look at what's the risk of that building being struck, like I said, we have to look at this plan area of the building, and also the shape has an effect too, but we look at the plan area. And so we've developed a new generation of tornado hazard maps that not only accounts for the spatial variations in different locations around the country, but we also account for what's the plan size of the building. So we're not worried about the square footage. We don't care how many stories the building is. We're worried about if you're looking at it from an aerial view, what is the footprint of the building and how big is that and that shape? And so the new tornado hazard maps that we developed for the first time account for that spatial difference.
So now we have this sort of nexus of geography and building size. So for instance, I might say like, okay, I'm going to build this type and size of building in this location, and the new guidance can help me better understand what I need to do in order to make that building as safe as possible that are most likely, correct?
Close. Mm-hmm. We developed the methodologies to better understand the wind load design, what we need to do for tornadoes, and we worked with the with a standards development organization called the American Society of Civil Engineers. And they develop what's called the ASCE-7 standard, which is minimum design loads for buildings and other structures. And so if you want to understand what kind of loads would an earthquake induce on your building, you would go to the ASCE-7. And then this ASCE standard becomes incorporated. We propose to incorporate that into the International Building Code. And that's the model building code, which is adopted by most communities around the country. So then when a local community, they will adopt this model building code, these guidelines and methods and rules that we've developed, they are incorporated by reference into what becomes the local building codes around the country.
And that's why there's a pretty long journey from disaster to safer buildings. Like Joplin was 15 years ago, and we are now starting to see the integration of what we learned there into more and more local codes. And that's because of this thing you're describing, right? Because we have to move from research to standards to model codes and then to local laws. Having been through this cycle, what have you learned about what we might be able to do to make the process move more quickly, not just for defense against tornadoes, but for fires and floods and all sorts of other disasters.
That's a challenge. You're right. The International Code Council, they've been looking at that. Here at NIST, we've met with their leadership on multiple occasions to see how can we speed the flow of research-based products into the codes of standard process so that it doesn't take so long. But the basic challenge there is in this particular case, we first had to do many years of research. Then we worked with American Society of Civil Engineers, and that's about a 3 or 4 year process because it's a consensus process. And there's hundreds of people that are involved in that process. And so you develop proposals, and every time that there's questions and votes or whatever, do we do this? And then we have to go back and make revisions. And then once that gets published, then there's a 3 year cycle of process time that it takes to update the code cycle. But then, as you were just mentioning, I said, there's a local process. That 2024 code was just recently published, right? And just in the last 2 years. And so then local communities have to decide. They have to take a look at it. What's changed? We're going to make a local evaluation. We're going to make local changes. They have their own process. Sometimes there's a state-level building code committee. Sometimes it's a county or a city-level organization that's in charge of building codes and standards and ordinances. The long tail, and that can be shortened with more community engagement and involvement if folks understand that there's real benefits of adopting the latest codes.
With that timeline in mind, because it necessarily takes a long time to do the research, to generate consensus, to write the new guidance, and then to get local communities to adopt it, how should modeling factor into the way that we're thinking about this? And what I mean by this is, you know, there's a place, for instance, called Tornado Alley in the United States. It's where we know from the past that the strongest and greatest numbers of tornadoes have always been, but we have begun to see a shift in that footprint in recent years, and climate researchers have employed simulations to show where Tornado Alley is likely to shift in the future. What role can these models play in helping us know where implemented standards are going to be most helpful?
So we talked about how long it takes for the code process to, we have to develop the guidance. So you said we get it into the standard. We take the standard and move it into the code and then codes. And that's one way to get the new requirements broadly implemented. That's not the only path. You don't always have to wait for what's in the standard to go into the code first. Sometimes a community like to get based on increased in costs standard directly. That's not the most common way, but it does happen. Another way to do that is to have voluntary adoption of the latest and greatest. And so if you're designing or building, if you're an owner, you're going to build a new building. And yes, I have to meet the minimum legal requirement is to meet the current code. And maybe your community is still on the 2018 building code or the 2021 building code. Well, if you want to have the tornado resistance, certainly as a building owner, you can ask your engineer and architect, hey, I'd like to have my building designed to the latest version so I can get that tornado resistant design built in.
And there's an economic case for that, right? I mean, like the case for that would be, look, I am pretty confident that even though doing the minimum might be cheaper right now, that adopting higher standards now is likely to save me in the future, not just on reconstruction costs, but potentially insurance costs as well.
Yes, exactly. And a study by the National Institute of Building Sciences, a collaboration with FEMA, a couple of years ago showed that on average, for every $1 spent on kind of hazard mitigation, and this is broadly across all of the hazards, whether it's improving your flood resistance, wind resistance, earthquake resistance, et cetera, results in a return of $11 of savings. So yeah, there is an economic case. There's a case of, you know, value engineering and what additional levels of safety and property protection that you'd like to get, less, you know, less risk in the future. The other thing is everything that we're doing, the exact details are a little bit different and the patterns are slightly different, but everything that we do to improve the strength for tornado is also going to improve your performance in any of these other kind of windstorms, which do occur more frequently, right?
And we also know that that risk profile is going to change over time. And when we're building a high school, a huge shopping center, even a home, we're building something that is intended to last for decades, maybe even a century. So let's talk about those changing patterns of risk. How do we factor that in?
We have a major project here that started several years ago at NIST called the Forward-Looking Building Standards Project. What is known about these changes and how would they affect building design? Because as you mentioned, if we design the building today and it gets constructed next year or something like that, that building is going to last 50, 75, 100 years, more sometimes. So we need to worry about not just what the extreme wind climate is today, but what is this climate going to look like 50 to 100 years from now? And we're developing maps that we would use to say, hey, what is that going to be the likely changes by more towards the end of the century? And so that we're covered for the design and the life of the whole building, not just designing for what the hazard conditions are now and not being able to address, hey, maybe things are changing in 20, 30, 40, 50 years from now.
We have more people today living in Tornado Alley and the expanded Tornado Alley than ever before, but we're not seeing more deaths and certainly not more deaths per capita. And I don't think we're likely to reach a world in which tornado deaths are completely a thing of the past. But do you think that with better standards, better code, better design, all based on better research, we can get close to a world in which it's far, far less common?
Yes, and that's our vision. In most places, we replace building stock at a rate of maybe 1%, 1.5% per year. So the buildings we have today are mainly the buildings that we're going to have for the next 20 or 30 years. Now, we look 30 years from now, maybe we have a third of the buildings are new then or have been renewed or something. So we do have to worry about our existing building stock. And there's things that we can do. There's somewhat better tools. We can also do a better job of, inside most schools, for example, right? You walk in, there'll be a little map showing where the fire exits are, right? Well, we don't have that for where do you go shelter for the building if there's a high wind event? Well, that's something that we could do by analyzing existing buildings, and that's a low cost, whatever, is put a plaque. So there's things that can be done there. But ultimately, ideally, when we move, significantly farther down in time where we've replaced a lot of the building stock and a lot of the building stock has this better construction, then we would expect to see a reduction in loss of life and loss of property.
I'm sure that from your vantage, sometimes it feels like movement and momentum toward these life-saving innovations is slow and maybe frustratingly slow sometimes. But when you look back and you think about what you were seeing in Joplin 15 years ago and what you are seeing now in terms of construction and awareness and efforts toward making the changes that need to be made, can you see that bend in that arc? And is it satisfying?
Yes, it's hugely satisfying because up until the Joplin tornado, it was really very limited to really just nuclear and storm shelters and maybe a few other very specialty kind of projects. And even the thought of designing for tornadoes or engineering research around that was just really pretty minimal. And now because the perception was that, oh, they're so rare, there's nothing we can do about them. We'd all have to live underground or in concrete bunkers. It would cost so much to be able to do anything about it. What are we going to do? Because there was somehow this idea that if you didn't design for the worst possible tornado, you couldn't do anything. And so that's one of the key things that we kind of discovered is, most tornadoes are not the worst tornado. Most tornadoes, which can still do bad damage, especially if your building is designed for it, but they have wind speeds of 135 miles per hour or less. We can design it. The wind speeds in Miami for hurricanes is 200, right? So we can design for high wind speeds. We know how to do that. But we need to get the right tools to make that happen. And so now, moving forward, it's 15 years from when the Joplin tornado occurred. The storm shelter industry and storm shelter design is becoming much more regular. A number of the building code, actually starting the 2015 version of the International Building Code, they started requiring storm shelters in schools and in emergency response facilities like fire, police, EMS. We have those tools. And so it's incredibly satisfying to see that we're, as a country now, we've taken this much more seriously and we're moving along the path that we need to improve our tornado hazard resilience.
That's Mark Levitan. He is the lead research engineer for the National Windstorm Impact Reduction Program at the National Institute of Standards and Technology. and he's been the lead investigator on many powerful tornadoes, including the 2011 storm in Joplin, Missouri. Mark, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Undisciplined is a production of Utah Public Radio, and if you happen to live in Utah, you can listen to us on UPR every Thursday morning at 10:30. If you're not in Utah, you can still listen to every episode of Undisciplined wherever you get your podcasts. Public radio stations around the country have had a substantial cut to funding, so now more than ever, it's important to support this work. If you're able, you can do that at donate.nprstations.org/UPR. Our producer is Maxim Dorian. Our theme music is Little Idea by Benjamin Tissot. And I'm Matthew LaPlante. Thanks for listening. Now go have big ideas.